New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. Our topic today is scandals at the ashram. And of course, there have been scandals at many ashrams. My guest today is Julie Anderson, who is here with me in Albuquerque. She made the long journey all the way from Australia to the United States and then to Albuquerque. Julie was an intimate companion of the guru Adidas Samraj for 16 years at his ashram in Fiji and elsewhere. She traveled with him to multiple ashrams. And many viewers will know that Adidas has been a controversial guru, sometimes referred to as a crazy wisdom guru. There have been some scandals associated with his guruship, if I can call it that, with his teaching, with his community. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you, Jeffrey. So this is a topic that I am familiar with, very intimately familiar with, and also am happy that you're asking these questions, because then perhaps I can help people know a little bit more about what really happened, and at least from my own direct experience, and then also help in understanding the purpose and the why of it and the outcome of it, again, in my own personal case, and perhaps represent a large portion of those who similarly have gone through that kind of process?
It seems to me that 80 to 85, maybe 90% of all of the gurus that have come to the United States in one way or another have been involved in scandals, typically of a sexual nature, a financial nature, emotional and physical abuse of devotees. It's been, I would say, more the rule than the exception, to my knowledge. It's very rare that a guru hasn't been touched by scandals of one type or another.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's fair enough to be said also not just associated with the U.S.
Yeah.
These kinds of things I've at least been aware of happening in many other countries, and sometimes the teachers or the gurus will come from other countries to the U.S. or vice versa. There's a lot of exchange going on relative to points of views and methods and trying to introduce different cultural ways of, or traditional ways of trying to teach or relate to human beings in the midst of their struggles or their seeking. So, you address specifically relative to the U.S. and I understand that, with the Western culture, in the U.S. in particular, there were a number of Indian teachers that came to the U.S. that actually had quite a positive reception. Yeah. However, what you state is really clear. There was always an element of controversy about it. And I'm thinking of Vivekananda, for example. And if you study a lot about the details of his life and practice, that he himself was also attempting to introduce something new into a Western culture. So there was a lot of fascination with him, a lot of curiosity, enamoring.
Vivekananda, to whom you're referring, came to the United States, if I recall, back in the 1890s.
Yes, yes.
And he was a very renowned Indian guru, one of the first. He attended the World Congress of Religions, I think, in Chicago. I believe it was 1893. And he associated with many prominent people, including, amongst others, William James, the father of American psychology.
Yes, that's right. That's right. He also had a relationship with Sri Aurobindo, which is another yogi that came to the U.S. that had very positive influence and continues to have established ashrams. And I think that because some of the teachers who came to the U.S. or went traveled to different parts of the world, they had an established tradition behind them. And given the time frame within which they arrived in the U.S., perhaps they may have been more openly received than others were, but it was much more difficult for, say, Chogyam Trungpa, who came here and had much more of a controversial welcome, but a large welcome, and a lot of his, what he established here still exists.
That's right.
And is flourishing. Yes. And again, he has a tradition behind him. However, he had a lot of potential controversies to relate to in the manner that he taught. And there's also Osho.
Yes.
Who is another man who comes from a traditional setting and attempted to bring something here to the West and was confronted with profound criticisms and had to go back to India. So, yes, as you indicated, there's quite a tradition for these controversies, and it's even more difficult for people who have, like Arida, went to India and received instructions and, you know, practiced and had their own journey in the U.S. and then in India and different parts of Europe, and then would come back to attempt to teach and bring something here. Now, that's a lot of people have done that.
Right.
Throughout, you know, the history of the U.S. as we...
Well, I would say offhand, Arida is probably the most prominent Westerner who went to India and came back to teach an Indian Hindu Vedanta-style, Advaita-style teaching in the United States. I think he's very likely the most prominent of those.
Right. So... in terms of the kind of media attention that he got, definitely. And I feel partly responsible for that in terms of what happened.
You were often at the center.
In 1985.
You yourself, if I recall, almost every story about Arida that appeared in the newspapers and magazines of that era would talk about the fact that one of his intimate companions was a former Playboy centerfold. That was always a titillating fact.
Well, yes, and that was in no uncertain terms exploitative. And was I feel, a violation of our privacy and an exaggeration and made much overly much of in terms of the actuality of what was happening for me personally.
Sure.
Whether I was a centerfold or not was irrelevant to the fact of what I actually chose to do in my life. That was a very important and serious matter to me.
But I can tell you, I spoke to other devotees when I was in San Rafael at the time and, you know, mingled occasionally with members of the community. Yeah. They would bring it up to me as well. And for them, it was a, sort of a source of pride.
That's funny.
It's like, you know, Donald Trump coming down the escalator with his fashion model wife.
That is really funny. That I never looked at it from that perspective.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? After all these years, I never really saw it that way. I never felt Arida present me that way, nor was I related to that way.
Yeah.
In my relationship to him. It was much too serious a matter. But of course, I am not ignorant in terms of understanding why it could be perceived that way and why people would have different emotions about it. Also different reactions.
But that's hardly scandalous, actually. I mean, the scandals themselves went way beyond that.
Yes, that's right. That isn't. That just happens to be a fact.
But normally, if you're writing a story about the scandal and you put that into the first paragraph, it'll keep people reading.
Yeah. Ah, well, it didn't really seem to do that, though, did it? In terms of Audie Daw's people's sustained interest, in terms of taking him seriously, that was titillating.
Yeah.
But then it didn't sustain the interest because Audie Daw really didn't play on it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't something that was significant for him.
No, but when it was written about in the context of a scandal,
exactly,
people read the scandal. That
yes,
the scandal might have been less interesting, but for that
fact. Right, yeah. And it did die out after a while. However, the bruising from it,
mm-hmm,
or the leftover from it has actually continued to have a negative impact because of the way that communications remain on web and online and just through people networking with one another. For example, I have a sister who was one of the ones that went to the island in 1985 after the scandal occurred. And this all revolved around my ex-boyfriend when I came to Audie Daw. And this case court presently is sealed, so there's no knowledge of exactly what the dialogue was or how it was resolved, except for what was put in the media.
Mm.
And this occurred years after I had moved on from him and he had moved on, had another relationship and a child and entered back into his life and became a very successful businessman and happily married. And yet then at a certain point in time, he and a couple other devotees decided to raise these issues as if they had been irrevocably damaged by what had happened. And it's in no uncertain terms my feeling about my particular relationship to this scandal and how it came into being is it was really about extorting money, trying to act as though they were genuinely concerned about what Audie Daw had done, to assume that they could have an effect such that they could prevent him from continuing to do what he did by legal means, by making some sort of threat. However, these matters were resolved out of court, and they were thrown out of court. They had no life to them except for what the media presented to the world,
mm-hmm,
and then how those things are still accessible online. The damage that was done was actually more personal damage to the devotees who were involved.
Especially yourself.
Especially myself. And it was traumatic. One of the most traumatic things that occurred in my life was the moment in time when I found out that there were a few individuals who were actually targeting my blood family and scaring them as if there was something terrible happening with me. And not just my immediate family, but my aunts and uncles and cousins and all of that became involved in it. And, of course, because of their love for me, they began to inquire and try to intervene in some fashion. And that's how Audie Daw and, had, you know, decided, well, they just, a number of them, as many as possible, should just come to the island and see how we're living. And so that's what occurred. And one of the...
You were in Fiji.
In Fiji at the time, yes.
Island of Naitumba.
Yes. And also news reporters were invited to the island of Naitumba. And we didn't put on a show for these people. I mean, they just came into the way that we were living, which was a natural ashram life. Of course, there were periods of time where we weren't living such a strict schedule of getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning in meditation and then yoga and then study and then service and then lunch and then more meditation and then study and, you know, a rigorous kind of routine and then meditation in the evening and then certain special, you know, puja practices and sitting with the guru and chanting and consideration about the traditions and discussion and education. We were involved in most of the time that's what we did over all the years of our life with him. Throw some salt and pepper in, and then you have periods of time where we would be involved in making use of what were called accessories. So the main accessories were beer. Sometimes in the very early days, there was whiskey, and then cigarettes. And then later on, at certain times, there was use of marijuana. There was no use of like hard drugs or any of that type of thing in all the years I was there. Mm-hmm. Now, if there was anything like that that occurred earlier on, I'm not aware of that. Mm-hmm. There were a couple aphrodisiacs that were used, and mainly they were traditional ones that people are familiar with. Marijuana can even be used that way at times. And so our experimentation was an augmentation to the process of samyama. So we would make use of these things for various purposes. One is that it magnifies an experiential manner of sensation or vision or release or purification or releasing taboos. Like they were all used in a ritual fashion in a manner in which we considered it a sacred process.
Adi Da was, as you've described earlier, a tantric guru.
Yes.
And
yes.
To my knowledge, he was never, for example, he came out of the tradition of Swami Muktananda, who was a predecessor, a man who, in fact, conferred upon him a certain degree of spiritual authority.
Yes.
And Muktananda was a person who denied that he was sexually active.
Correct.
However, it subsequently came out that was a lie.
That's right.
And in Adi Da's case, he never denied it.
No, he did not deny it, and he was not hidden about anything. Obviously, there was confidentiality in the sense of wanting to respect and honor the privacy of devotees. And specifically, there were certain devotees who might need privacy more than others. Perhaps they had positions of responsibility in the world, for example, that certain levels of privacy needed to be maintained. There's certain levels of privacy relative to just very intimate matters, without going into a lot of detail. That's really nobody else's business, apart from the fact that, yes, did we experiment in social and sexual and dietary and use of accessories and how they related to use by shamans or tantric traditions or yoga altogether? Absolutely we did, because there wasn't a denial in relationship to life, and it's something that really wasn't much different than a lot of what a huge portion of humanity were involved in anyway. It's just that I feel, and I this became obvious to me over time, was that it again had to do with the difficulty with the guru function itself and not really understanding the wide range of manners in which teachers and gurus have functioned within different cultures. And particularly in the West, the lack of trusting of gurus because of what was happening in the media earlier on, even before Adi Da's coming to view in this fashion, really terrible things had happened where people did abuse people and abuse their positions of authority, mm-hmm. And just awful, awful, devastating things. And when we began to be aware that people were likening Adi Da to those kinds of individuals, for us personally, that was devastating. Did that mean that it didn't evoke a process of observation in our own life in relationship to him? No, it actually did do that. That being brought to our attention was more fuel for the process of self-observation and self-understanding, and then to feel what in ourselves actually corresponded with such notions, why, what was true, what wasn't, what level of responsibility did we assume in relationship to it, how were we childishly related to him, in effect giving our power over, mm-hmm. because we weren't assuming responsibility for the choices that we were making with him. So it was useful. As painful as it has been, it has also been useful, but it has been a scar mm-hmm. in the collective psyche, and it has been a cog in the wheel in terms of the ability of us to be able to communicate about Adi Da and what really happened without this coming up. And I don't know if that will ever change, because even when you look throughout history, even at Christ and many people who have, you know, huge religions have been founded on the basis of these realizers, and there are still aspects that are never going to be forgotten, and they are controversial, and people are always trying to investigate about whether they're true or not, what really did or didn't happen. So one thing that's wonderful about Adi Da and the archives that exists now around his life, everything is recorded. Mm-hmm. Like it's not even going to be just a matter of word of mouth or even what I could say to you now, although that is valuable. But there are recordings of these gatherings that we had with him making use of accessories. Mm-hmm. There's even video footage. In the earlier days, I think there was even video footage of gatherings in which individuals would be experimenting sexually. And again, that was a tool that was used in terms of being able to view and reflect. There were artistic means in which we would take photos or pictures of ourselves in different ways to assess our sense of our self-image, you know, and others viewing us or are viewing ourselves and comparisons. And for example, when I first came about, because I had been the Playboy centerfold, one of the first things that I did because I was an artist is that I took images of the women that were around him. But not only did I do that, I actually created sets, you know, for each of the women that corresponded with a sense of their being and a sense of their history and iconographic imagery associated with it and their relationship to Adi Da. I did this with about 9 other women and would place them in these, I would paint big, huge images of backgrounds, mm-hmm. you know, for them to be posed against. And here again is a culture in which we're not actually assuming that the body itself is a negative. Like you do not negate the body. All of it, all of its parts are not to be ignored, dismissed, negated, to be presumed to be disgusting, something that you don't want to actually relate very directly to in order to take responsibility for it, mm-hmm. and to be able to get into all of the things that's the nitty gritty, the ghosts, the goblins, the shadows, the emotions that you might feel bad or guilty about. We got into all of it. Yeah. And from many traditional perspectives, particularly a fundamentalist Christian culture, would find that to be absolutely abhorrent, mm-hmm. that you would even think of doing anything like that because it's nasty.
Well, to be fair, though, there have been plenty of scandals within the churches, certainly enormous scandals That's within true. The Catholic Church, but I hear it from my Protestant friends as well. Yes. These kinds of scandals are not limited to yogi.
That's right. That's right. And what that reflects is where the human psyche tends to gravitate. And where complications lie, mm-hmm. in the emotional, sexual, social, mm-hmm. and political arena of our life with one another. And Adi Da, as he indicated when he first began to teach, when he came back from India after having been given the acknowledgement by Baba Muktananda that he was free to teach and be a guru in his own right, based upon the name, the intimate private name of Lovananda that was given to him, and Dayananda, which was a name that was given to him in writing, that there's a actual, you know, letter from Baba Muktananda blessing him. And of course, there's scandal even around his relationship with Baba Muktananda, because Adi Da came there as a serious aspirant, and there was the own exchange that occurred between him and Baba that was fiery. Mm-hmm. You know, and Adi Da was challenging something in Baba Muktananda relative to Adi Da trying to communicate to him how his process and realization was moving beyond and above himself as Baba Muktananda to Bhagavan Nityananda, and Bhagavan Nityananda to the goddess, and the goddess to the Virgin Mary, and the Virgin Mary to Christ, and then circling back around and integrating with Ramana Maharshi and different traditions. And so there's quite a vast integration of a lot of different yogic processes and realizations and understanding about the nature of consciousness and being and energy itself, or the Shakti. Mm-hmm. And that whole process of his life was a tantric evaluation. It wasn't an abstraction. It was a full engagement in it. So when he began to teach and he returned, he realized that the Westerners that came to him, that he was given, he regarded whoever came to him was being given to him. Like, he didn't go out and seek people. They came to him. They wanted to be around him because it was obvious to them that he was transmitting, you know, yogic phenomena, transmitting love and blessings and insight, and they could come around him and he was available for them to ask questions, and they'd have dialogues together about all sorts of every aspects of life. I wasn't there in the very early days, but from what I understand and what's available as a lot of resource material that he wrote and spoke and video footage and all of that, that it was very, very open. But he realized early on that the people who came to him weren't prepared to actually practice a true yoga of spiritual sorts or even transcendental, because their foundation development as a human being was retarded, really. And I don't mean that in a negative way of being incapable somehow or other, you know, structurally or mentally, but just emotionally immature, not humanly responsible fully in being able to be an independent, mature human being responsible for their choices, and knowing that as an adult, this is something they were freely entering into in relationship to him. Now, he knew that, and he realized that he had to then submit himself to try to teach people to grow beyond these limits, as what he describes as the first three stages of life. So that occupied him. And it was out of that where the scandals came about, because he was in situations where people were sexually experimenting with one another. And there was emotional reactivity between agreed upon intimate partners, and then partners expressing some other kind of interest or promiscuity. And then there was an agreement to say, experiment. And then what does this mean if you do this, and how does it affect the partner? And these kinds of things occurred, you know, to make evaluation and get to know yourself. This isn't uncommon, actually, if you go to, say, a sexual therapist these days. I mean, in various forms of professions, in addition to yogis, in addition to different kinds of gurus, this is a knowledge that you must have in order to function yogically.
And in fact, also, we're talking about the 1970s,
yes,
the 1980s. It's an era in which it was characterized as being the sexual revolution.
Well,
birth control had become widely available,
yes,
for example. And you know, on college campuses and in cities, and probably in towns and in villages all across the world, at least in the Western world, this sort of experimentation was going on. And for all I know, it always has been going on.
Yes,
yes. And it happened to be more in the public eye at that time again.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed even as a young girl that even though I grew up in a Mormon family, Mormon tradition, which was very, I'm about to say puritanical, but then I realize actually that's not altogether true, because of the fact that the men had many wives.
Yeah.
You know, so there was an unconventional element of that church,
mm-hmm,
and establishment of that religion, which faced a lot of controversy when it was first established.
It still is controversial.
And it still is,
yeah.
Yes. And I can guarantee you that there are amazingly wonderful, mature, moral Mormons. You know, the characterization of the controversy around Mormonism, I mean, it will and probably stay, and there are different things that happened within their hierarchical structure that, and financially, and all sorts of scandals around all of that that occurred. But this religion is extremely well established. And very, very, their mission is very, very strong. I think in part, and it's also connected with, originally, with the Hebrew tribes of Israel. You know, so there's the linking of traditions there that I don't think a lot of people are really aware of unless they've studied the history of the Mormon doctrine. But I think a lot of these scandals survive and are fed by a lack of real study and naivete and just being gravitated towards wanting to, you know, read the fodder and find it some way justifying a reaction that you have in yourself, or because you don't like someone or something, then it's a way of spreading gossip and undermining something that actually could potentially have some real integrity to it.
It's very easy to protect oneself from opening up to the possibilities of the world by being judgmental.
There you go. And I would say that you are very sensitive to not doing that. Am I right in that?
Well, I try.
Yeah. I mean, because I've had some conversations with me which have helped me feel how open you are to feeling that every voice and possibility should be heard. You know, that it is useful to be able to give people room to communicate about these possibilities. And because it does expand our horizon and our consciousness in order to be able to make true evaluations and choices.
I'm going to deviate a little bit from our discussion just to say there was a frequent guest on this channel who I once accused of being a warmonger.
Right.
And I invited him to come on the channel and defend his, what I thought of as a warmongering position. And he declined. But it would have been okay with me to allow that kind of a discussion. Even somebody who's saying we should launch an unprovoked war. It's a conversation that could be held. But now with regard to Adida. I think I want to make it clear for our viewers in case there's any ambiguity, and correct me if I'm wrong. But my understanding of your perspective, after having been in an intimate companion of him for 16 years, and then another 16 years after that, closely involved with the community, and another 16 years after that, since he died, still, I think, having what you would call an intimate spiritual connection with him after his death, I am under the impression that you don't find any fault in his behavior.
Right. So, okay, now that is an interesting way of putting it, okay? I don't know if I completely agree with that.
Okay.
I don't think that there is any human being that has ever existed that has been without fault. Okay. I think that mistakes or faults, liabilities, limits are part of this birth. And those are the very important matters which we must understand and grow beyond. And I would say in my understanding and living with Adida intimately and in the fashions that you described that have continued, apart from just the physical human relationship, he epitomized to me and taught me not to dismiss, lie, or deceive, or to be hidden about the fact that there are such faults. And that there are such limits, and taught me how to go beyond them without fooling myself or being deceptive in relationship to others, and how important honesty is in relationship to these matters. So did Adida make mistakes? Yes. Were there faults in his character? Yes. Like he would talk about himself as this boisterous, you know, New Yorker, you know, even teasing and even in the kind of vital, gross way that he was embodied, there were certain qualities in himself that, you know, he would joke and mock himself about. Now, many times religious and spiritual practitioners will feel that there's something necessary to try to change and become something completely different than the qualities of what you're born with and what you have to deal with. We spent many times and various periods of time attempting to do that, to conform ourselves to a certain expectation of what it looks like to be truly religious or spiritual. In all aspects of life, you know, including being absolutely no eye contact with men, dressing a certain way that you're incredibly, you know, even nun-like in your costume, you know, separation of the sexes, only eating certain things so that you appear a certain way that creates a certain sattvic balance in you, agreeing for certain periods of time there will be absolutely no talking, you know, we'll have non-speech. I mean, we would apply these different forms of discipline that had to do with trying to change your behavior as a means to be able to realize. And in the engagement of that process, and they weren't just like, you know, for a day or two. I mean, we take these disciplines on for sometimes long periods of time and come to a point of understanding that no matter how much we applied a requirement to try to change this psychophysical mechanism to look and be a certain way, that in and of itself did not actually serve awakening, didn't serve the process of awakening to consciousness itself as the self position. Did certain practices help to reveal something to you about what real ego self transcending yoga is? Absolutely, unquestioningly. Mm-hmm. But not just the restrictive disciplines, but also the indulging in certain things that you would feel might be taboo. Because there were a lot of people who would come around Adida as spiritual seekers who had been part of different traditions. Like many Buddhists came to Adida who had spent many years in really strict, severe settings of ascetic life. And so for them to come in and feeling that they're going to get something maybe somewhat different, they didn't know exactly what, but then all of a sudden we're having a party with him, you know, and we're listening to, you know, we're not doing the Om Mani Padme Om, you know, we're not like just doing all of the mantric chants or the, you know, invocations and all that kind of thing, but we're actually dancing to rock music or something. These they're counter-egoic disciplines that end up reflecting something to what the ego is holding on to as an identity. Whether it's actually something that they're feeling bound to or something that they aspire to, actually is confronting. And it's the identity, the act of identification that Adida was always dealing with to undermine the necessity for having realization be dependent upon a certain form of experience and experiencing having to be something that conforms to what you have in mind, mm-hmm. or wanting to be seen as objectively, or experiencing internally as being required to awaken into the consciousness domain.
I think it's very tricky, though, when it comes to the question of abuse.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
I'm thinking, for example, of Meher Baba, who is regarded as an avatar by his disciples. And if I recall correctly, he was awakened when another Sufi came and threw a rock at him and hit him right in the forehead with a rock.
Yes, yes.
Or other examples of Zen masters who come around with a stick and hit their students with a stick. And sometimes that helps to awaken them.
Sure, sure.
But there have been discussions in, for example, at the Esalen Institute, a human potential institute here in America. They had seminars on what they called spiritual tyranny. Sure. And there seemed to be many examples of, and in other ashrams, of people who were exploited and abused with no result of, you know, this helped me to awaken at all. It was just pure exploitation. Did you ever experience yourself, or did you ever know of anybody in the ashrams where you were who felt themselves to be exploited in that way?
The people that I know and have maintained an intimacy with that I actually was involved in with myself personally?
Yeah.
No. Are there people that did feel that way that I'm aware of who have come around Adida? Yes. Mm-hmm. So And I don't dismiss their experience as though they're being dishonest or because I don't know it directly. But speaking for myself then, what I would say in the periods we've spoken about this before, the time when I had to go through therapy and re-examining everything that occurred in my relationship with Adidah, there were various things that occurred with me in the context of our emotional sexual intimacy and with the context of that consideration with other people that I felt really hurt by. And it was mainly a matter of feeling betrayed. And also, in situations where I felt like I didn't really want to do this thing, but I had to accept that I agreed to do it. And if I really didn't want to be involved in these things, there was never any absolute requirement to have to do that. Mm-hmm. Of course, there was the groupthink, you know, and the kind of pressures of what, if you didn't involve yourself, you know, how you might feel about that or how you might then be set aside and not be involved because you couldn't agree to be involved in this type of experiment or this kind of consideration or wanting to volunteer your, not only yourself, but your relationship with one another. You'd volunteer to participate in things that would be very testing and confronting. I feel that, those, now that I've actually stayed with the process and integrated what occurred all together, were some of the times that were the most useful. Mm-hmm. And the periods of time that as hard and as testing as they were actually grew me more than even the kinds of phenomenal experiences that I could have had or did have that I've spoken about before that were readily available and often. Mm-hmm. Because, again, of the fact that our liabilities of being embodied physical beings are emotional and sexual and Oedipal and political and social personas so much dominate our culture that if we can't break free from feeling confined and bound to certain expectations, then we will not be able to grow and make wise choices for ourselves in relationship to any aspect of life. So even though there was a lot of, appeared to be a lot of group pressure or dynamics of what you presumed you had to do because the guru was involved, all of that growth of going beyond those notions and those limits were immeasurably important in terms of the spiritual process. All that being said, I completely, fully, sympathetically, and empathetically and compassionately can understand why people can remain stuck in reactive emotions of feeling somehow hurt and betrayed and not being able to understand what happened or why. And if any individual, I would suggest, if any individual feels themselves stuck in that kind of a position, not only in relationship to Adidah, any aspect of life and in any relationship to a tradition or spiritual teacher, that you can reclaim your freedom. It's completely possible to reclaim your freedom and your clarity, but you have to be willing to go through an equally as difficult process to re-go through the whole thing again and to examine it with people that you feel can help you become maturely related to it and release the victim mentality. And that's not to say that maybe there were mistakes that were made or there were things that somebody said or did that might have hurt you. I'm not dismissing that that's a possibility. I couldn't enumerate, you know, or speak to all those who may feel that way, but having been one who I could have ended the process there and felt like I was justified in just walking away and saying, this has failed, mm-hmm. this is not going to work, I gave myself over 100% and I just feel like this was fruitless. I knew too deeply in my heart that wasn't true. I knew that there was a profundity to it that was much, much more significant than what were real and important reactions that I had to understand more about and grow humanly to take responsibility for. And I would imagine that, you know, even if you didn't understand spirituality, that that kind of growth is necessary just for a human being, even if they aren't a religious or spiritual practitioner.
Well, an interesting parallel that I'm aware of is in the whole question of alien abductions.
Right.
I have interviewed many times Whitley Strieber, who was quite clear. His home was invaded by some alien beings who had sex with him.
Right.
And he wasn't necessarily, as pleasurable as it may have been, he wasn't a voluntary participant. It was sort of forced upon him. And in fact, he tells me that he still has to use some sort of medicinal ointment in his rectum because he was injured. In the process, an injury that occurred in the 1980s that he still suffers from. And yet he wrote a book called Communion about this experience, in which he suggested that as horrific as it was at the time, he's grateful for it.
Well, that's certainly a process of growing up and going beyond. I don't know his story at all, but I can understand the parallel in the sense that the experiences that I've had, and similarly to the gentleman that you're speaking about, and you could say millions without even exaggerating, different forms of experiences that have been traumatic for people. I think Gabor speaks about that these days in terms of his helping people about trauma. The worst thing that you can do is not allow people to speak freely about what it is that they experienced, and to have a kind and compassionate and open at heart to be able to receive and to feel and to help someone not be shamed by it or feel guilty about it or think that you're just crazy because you're speaking about things that maybe most of society would not even want to hear about or would ignore. And yet, I know from my own experience in life, even before coming to Adi Da, at a very young age, and then in my experience as being in LA and then with the Playboy stuff and entering into realms of possibility that, you could say I have experienced and put myself in situations where I have experienced things that could be described as traumatic. And those, I can still feel those wounds to some degree, but the fact that I can feel the wound is not the problem. If I maintain a reaction to the event or the pain of it, and I don't allow myself to feel through it and to stand free in relationship to it, then it becomes something else and it maintains a pain and an obstruction in my ability to grow. So that's just my, and in my time with, the doctor that I was involved with, you know, particularly going back into, hypnosis a few times and realizing that a lot of what I experienced as trauma wasn't just in this lifetime. And a lot of that, what I experienced with Adi Da was a necessary reemergence of things that were actually related to post-life matters and even being in between life matters. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's a lot of levels of awareness that it's very important that, we don't dismiss the possibility for people being able to grow beyond traumas that are difficult to speak about.
I find, for example, as a parapsychologist, there's something very ironic, which is that a high percentage of individuals who experience spontaneous psychic experiences, which for me, I think I regard that as a positive thing, largely. It's opening up to a wider sense of yourself. But these experiences were often, I think, triggered by early childhood abuse that these people suffered from. It's as if having been abused as a child pushes the child to open up inner worlds as a refuge that they might not otherwise have done. I wasn't abused. I never opened up such inner worlds. Do I feel deprived in that regard? Not really, but nevertheless, I don't think child abuse is ever justifiable, but I can see that on occasion positive things come of it.
No. Well, that ties in with the conversations that we had about the matter of the light and the dark, and how does that all play? How does that become a perfect Leela? How does that become a perfection of divine play? Mm-hmm. What does that have to do with God? It's like an experience can happen, and oftentimes you will hear religious or spiritual practitioners say something like to the effect of, "Oh, God meant that to be. That was meant to happen," or I don't know if I ascribe to that altogether, because I feel that there is the necessity for the human individual to participate in it, not in a way that is so passive that you are depending upon something external to you to liberate you. And that it is only grace itself, as though it's some sort of abstract amorphous thing that's going to heal and cure all and save all. There's much more responsibility on the part of the individual to participate in the spiritual and transcendental spiritual process for there to be any kind of true healing. Because all of these injuries have everything to do with the heart, even if wherever it may have occurred psychophysically in relationship to the body, through all the different means through which one can be injured, even if it's emotional or mental or physical, that the way that it ends up registering as being trauma is that you have been unloved. You've been violated. You've been hurt. You've been disrespected. You haven't been taken into account. And you haven't been cherished. You haven't been regarded as sacred. There hasn't been a sensitivity to the preciousness of being incarnate as a human being. So in relationship to the process with Adida, that sensitivity to the heart, and as the way of the heart, that the true healing had to occur in the heart itself. And if the being isn't able to grow in the dimensions that we've spoken of before, which isn't just unique to Adida in terms of understanding human growth and awakening, the human being has to grow up and take responsibility beyond anything and everything that you can possibly experience in life. Now, that doesn't mean that that may actually happen within one lifetime. And this is what I learned in therapy, is that what you're saying is true about how sometimes previous traumas can initiate or be a catalyst for some form of growth or some form of awakening or catapulting you into another refuge, or something opens up, a doorway opens up. But then again, it requires the individual to choose to do that in a positive way, you know, rather than using it again just to fuel the fact that I'm betrayed and I'm unloved and I will never forget you for hurting me and I'm just a victim forever.
It's so strange. I do recall one of my early experiences at the community in San Rafael, and a woman stood up and talked about how grateful she was to Adida because he broke her heart.
Right. So wondering what she meant by that.
Yeah. Well, I think sometimes it's good to have a broken heart. You develop compassion for yourself and for others.
And my understanding of that communication is results in what you're describing, that compassion and that tolerance and that availability for the open heart. And I also feel it as my life have always assumed that, getting positive attention, being able to achieve something and then be rewarded for it or congratulated, because there are certain people, particularly parents or my father, wanting to be able to please them or pleasing Adida or whatever, that there's always a sense of gratification that may come about of that. And sometimes that happens. But the world is not dependable in that way. Like, what comes back at you? So many unexpected things can come at you, even in the face of being a good person. Yeah. Horrible things happen to good people.
Yeah, and I, for one, don't particularly care to have my heart broken.
Yeah, you wouldn't want that. However, I think we've spoken about this, but what he describes as positive disillusionment, mm-hmm. inevitably the heart will be broken in the fact that what you love will die. Mm-hmm. Your whole sense of self, it will be let go in terms of your sense of familiarity in this lifetime. The attachments to things that you cherish and find valuable, even if it be, whatever it is, an object or an other, an intimacy, a child, an experience, an achievement, all of those things can be destroyed in one fell swoop, unexpectedly. And your life could change utterly, and all of that can be erased. Mm-hmm. And so he's not saying meditate on that, but be wise, be made wise by it. Exercise discrimination in relationship to the condition that we find ourselves in. And that's in part what this woman would mean by, it's a part of radical understanding. It's awakening beyond the illusion that this world is going to satisfy you, that you can depend upon experience to satisfy you. And that in and of itself breaks the heart. And what that means is that the heart, has to cease to depend upon conditions to feel the connection to love. Mm-hmm. That the heart is broken in love when it realizes that love is not lost, that it is actually a constant. So there is a positive breaking of the heart that enables you to go beyond the limit of being dependent upon conditions for love. Mm-hmm. And I know what she's saying when she says that. And Adida has one thing that he says, realization is very much combined with a wound that churns and never heals. Because the heart is always open. And for the heart to be open, you have to accept that wound of love. And because so long as you are embodied, you, as much love as you can give, like, you know how much you feel you can love someone and yet they may not ever really be able to receive it? You ever, you, no matter how much you want to show your love or give your love, there's even the impossibility in a certain way of being certain that that someone really knows how much you care about them.
Because they can't love themselves.
Yeah. And, or love back or reciprocate it. That's an heartbreak.
Yeah.
But is that an excuse to stop loving?
Well, of course not.
No, but you would say that, but many people wouldn't. You see?
Walk away. You don't need that.
a lot of humanity wouldn't have that response at all. You know, that they meditate on the justification to be upset about the fact that they did not get what they wanted in return.
Well, to me, the irony is this, Julie. We live in a world where there's enormous pain and suffering, legitimate pain and suffering of innocent people, children, the suffering of children or innocent animals. It's unspeakable. Mm-hmm. It's so vast.
Mm-hmm.
And my sense is, speaking for myself and for practically everybody I know, we protect ourselves from having to feel the pain of the world, and we do that by numbing ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And when we numb ourselves that way, yes, we can wall off the suffering of other people. We can build a little paradise for ourselves, which I think I've done pretty successfully. But there's a cost, and the cost is the heart gets closed, and not just the heart, the consciousness gets closed as a result. And humans, the human population, from my perspective as a parapsychologist, we don't achieve our full potential because we close ourselves off from the suffering of the world.
Yeah, that's significant. That's very significant. Significant confession, significant understanding, significant insight. And so true. There are the gesture to want to protect and to yourself and loved ones is natural. And of course, we will do that, and it's appropriate to do so. But what you're speaking about also, if you take it too far, then you can become overly protective, and it does become a cloistering or manner in which you're not sensitized to the condition that most of humanity is actually in. Mm. And there is a reasoning, it is reasonable to assume that some people might choose to do that, but then I also, felt in alignment with what you were saying is that then you're not also available to try to help. You're not a participant in being aware of what's happening so that you can then also serve others in a manner in which I feel, what is the point of being alive if all you're involved in is just protecting yourself in your small little sphere, when in reality that really doesn't even exist in truth. We're so interconnected and dependent on everyone and everything, literally, at deep levels of being, that this form of isolation, it's an illusion. It doesn't really exist, and you have to work really hard to protect it. And look at how many people's lives get blown apart, even if they have achieved it. Mm-hmm. Not that I would wish that on them by any stretch of the imagination, but the way of the heart in my relationship to Adi Da is a reality awakening, reality to the love bliss of the nature of consciousness itself, but a reality awakening to the limited condition within which we find ourselves experientially. So that's the balance that needs to be maintained. That's not easy. It's always a challenge to meet that.
Well, we started out by talking about the scandal at the ashram, and I don't know that we dug into it as fully as we might, especially when you consider that when you first arrived in the community of Adi Da, you were with your boyfriend.
Yep.
Eventually, you split up. Mm. You became an intimate companion of Adi Da himself. Your boyfriend remained in the community. He found another woman and married and had a child.
Yes.
And he was a member of the community, I gather, at the time when he launched some sort of legal action.
Yes. So from what I understand, and I have spoken to him even within the last few years, I felt a movement to do so just out of compassion and out of wanting to apologize if there was something that I did to hurt him, that caused him to do what he did. But I won't mention anything about that presently in this moment, but going back a ways to that period of time, from what he communicated at that time and to my family was that he was concerned that it was his fault that I was involved in the situation that I was in. He had somehow or other felt that I had made a choice that I wasn't mature enough to be able to make the choice that I did. And he's looking back in time in retrospect. And this is many, many years past, almost 9 years to be exact, that had passed already. And he was not in any reality context to actually know anything about what my life was personally like. I had never had any further conversations with him. So what he was basing his feelings on was gossip and hearsay that would go and reverberate out through the ashram. And then oftentimes what we were involved in intimately in relationship to Adi Da sometimes would be attempted to be duplicated throughout different regions in the other parts of the ashrams and the worlds. And this is, I'm talking about experimentation relative to every aspect of life, not just emotional, sexual, but even with meditation and yoga and different forms of ritual practices and puja and worship.
Well, he was a role model for the whole community.
Yeah. In that regard. However, he would always say, don't do as I do. because of his unique function. Mm-hmm. You know, he was participating in saying that I am reflecting you to yourselves. I am living with you in your likeness to help you see something about what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And so he's freely participating with us, so that we could then learn in that dynamic relationship. And so while he would say that, it was difficult for us to always remember it because it became so intimate, you know, in the emotions and the involvement in it. And because even devotees who weren't physically there, they felt somehow or other that they were intimately connected because of however they felt his transmission. Mm-hmm. So people from afar were always involved in this dynamic process with him. And it was always something that was carried out into the general community. Now, part of the virtue of my having experienced being at a distance from Adida, I was aware that many of those kinds of considerations were still happening with him, even after I wasn't in his physical company anymore. And I saw how these things would reverberate and how they would get enacted out into the community. Mm-hmm. And I can guarantee you it was nothing like what happened being directly with Adida. Mm-hmm. The purity of it, the seriousness of it, the maturity of the individuals involved and having a master right there present with you, it turned it into something very different. So a lot of what, for example, that Mark may have experienced and many other devotees may have experienced in various regions that would have been like telephone almost, you know, communications that would come on down or interpretations of what was happening or choices of doing things a certain way, it would lose integrity. And that's not difficult to do. Yeah. Sadly, it's one of the primary liabilities, you know, in trying to set up a culture or an organization that's going to be based on principles by people who are supposed to initiate these processes in a mature fashion, who have the ability to do that, and then have people try to duplicate that who actually are not qualified to do so. And sadly, that did happen. However, those circumstances were made use of to try to learn something from that, mm-hmm. you know, no matter where it occurred. And the responsibility would always rest with the individuals who were adults, you know, 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s. So it wasn't like there were children who were involved in these experiments. There's a lot that happened. And I can't know it or account for it because there were a lot of different communities all over the world. But I do know that people did begin to feel various forms of reactions about whether they were involved, whether they weren't involved, whether they were inside, whether they were outside. What kind of kudos did you get for being inside and involved? And were you rejected if you couldn't participate? The politics involved in that, the social dynamics. So it's a complex situation altogether, and this isn't typical of just being around Adida. It's typical of any organization. Mm-hmm. You know, you get it even just going to school, you know, just being in a school with students, you know, whether you're in kindergarten or elementary school on up. There's political organizations, mm-hmm. various kinds of groups that have certain things that they're interested in, you know, and really passionate about. You can get these kinds of dynamics happening. So the reactions that people have had about Adida, the interesting part to me is that given the thousands and thousands of people who came through his house, literally, not just in the ashrams, but actually through his home, because I'm aware of thousands and thousands having come through his home, mm-hmm. And hundreds being him working with very directly. And the numbers of people who, as a result of that, have walked away and felt like they really wanted to do damage to him and to the organization as a result, statistically speaking, is relatively small. Mm-hmm. Does that justify anyone feeling or having actually been hurt? No. I don't think statistics justify any kind of abuse or damage if that actually really happened. Would I be able to say unequivocally that never occurred in any situation? No. I wouldn't do that because I don't want to, I'm not going to argue for something and argue for it in a way that isn't true and it wouldn't even be real. It's not possible for people to have not done things like that. For example, I'll speak about myself in terms of ways that I've experienced it directly. During periods of gatherings where we would make use of accessories, particularly alcohol, alcohol would create much more volatility and potential wildness than making use of marijuana. Okay. Marijuana has a completely different impact in the manner of what we would call, consideration or samyama or investigation. I mean, you can make use of marijuana and particularly the strains that exist and such. There's ways to enter into things that have an actual, enlightening effect, and experiential effect that's very heightening. We would always have to check ourselves the morning after to make sure that what we experienced had any reality to it whatsoever. You know, you can, like any kind of an awakening that you can have making use of a substance, you know, does that sustain itself? Is it actually really true? Have you learned something from it? Or is it something that you're going to have to keep re-experiencing, becoming an addict to the substance? Okay. But with alcohol, there was a liberalism that began to be exhibited, and particularly in emotional terms. It was a way in which people would reveal things about themselves that oftentimes they would feel really embarrassed by. So, say for example, like one thing that's coming to my head is that I would end up, I'm an art student. I was a Playboy centerfold. Okay. I'm not embarrassed about being naked. So I would get up and during periods of dancing or whatever, I would get up and I would do really lewd dances, you know, or get really, exotic or whatever, erotic, you know, that kind of thing. And then, of course, the next day when I'm sober and it's all passed, and then I'm really embarrassed, right? Who caused that? Am I going to blame somebody else for something I chose to do in a situation in which I actually chose to drink however many cans of beer I chose to drink? Mm-hmm. And here I am, I'm an adult. However, somebody that might have been intimate with me, and say it's this gentleman who decided to take issue with it, that I was being coerced. Or that it's Adi Da's fault, because I was in a gathering in which I was supposed to be being trained to be a spiritual practitioner. And because we used alcohol, he was being abusive and coercive because that happened. And whereas at the time when this came up in 1985, I talked to this gentleman and said to him, this is not real. There's nothing about what is going on with me that you need to be concerned about. Did that mean that I hadn't experienced difficulty, or that I hadn't felt hurt or betrayed or embarrassed or even potentially violated? Say, for example, I might have been doing that kind of dance and some man came up to me and decided to put his hand up my butt, or, you know, grab me in a certain inappropriate way. Maybe that happened. Yeah. Okay, grab my body in some way, decided that he wanted to have some sort of sexual intimacy with me. Those were all possibilities, but it was part of the learning process relative to, okay, you do that kind of thing, there are consequences. You want to learn about this? Well, I could have learned it in that circumstance, or I could have gone out and had a life that I would have been embroiled in that for God knows how many years before I learned the lesson. So I actually feel really grateful that there were lessons that I learned in a situation in which there were boundaries. You know, that there were agreements in terms of what we did with one another. And you could wake up in the morning in a safe situation in which we could talk about it freely. You know, talk about all of it freely. And that's what Adi Da did with us for really, really, really long time, to the point where he said, you all are addicted to this process. You want to keep doing this over and over and over again. You're not getting the lesson of it. Therefore, there's no purpose in continuing it. Were lessons learned by some people? Yes. Were lessons not learned by some people? Yes. But this has to do with the 1985 event too, is that no more working that way. We've done it. The lessons have been taught. If you don't want to make use of what's been revealed, that's your business. But I'm not going to do that with you anymore. It's not necessary. So I feel like in the time in which the 1985 event occurred, no matter how much I tried to communicate that there was no reason to be concerned, it still went ahead and did great damage. in relationship to my life and my family. And my family still suffers it, even to this holiday and time that I came here, and which ended up not being a holiday because my mother passed on. But I still have conversations with my brothers and sisters who are still fully wanting to cognize what happened because of gossip that they're still hearing from another direction. You know, and I'm having to say to my sister, if you want to know something, don't listen to the gossip. You've got to listen to me directly. You know, I'm not going to lie to you. You know, do I lie to you? You actually feel that I lie to you? You know, so there's even reverberations of continuing to have these dialogues. One of the things that the psychiatrist told me at one point, because I still have contact with him and through this process that I went through, periodically I reconnect with him. And, he said to me, when I told him that I'm trying to keep readdressing this and helping people feel beyond it, he said, don't be an idiot. He said, you can't learn other people's lessons for them.
Mm. Well, besides the incident in 1985 or 6 involving your family and your ex-boyfriend, were there other scandals? Were there other lawsuits, for example?
I believe there was actually something that was threatened earlier on, and I only have a vague memory of it because it was around the time when I first arrived. And it was, remember the time I told you that I was doing photographic images of the women,
mm-hmm.
you know, and doing the art sets and doing my artistic work. And during that period of time, I wasn't involved in the inner circle in the sense of the workings of what was happening. There were always people who liaised with the outer culture, those who were interested with the mission, with the institutional mm-hmm. aspect, with lawyers, financial. I wasn't involved in any of that. So, but I was aware that there was something that did occur because at a certain point, I remember being told that it would be a good idea to make sure that all of our whatever kinds of things that we had that were writings or diaries of our own personal process, that it would be good to actually burn them.
Oh.
And when I heard about that, I thought, what the hell? And why would we want to do that? This is precious. This is all incredibly precious. That instruction didn't come from Adida, I found out. That came from individuals who themselves had some guilt in terms of relationship to what they did mm-hmm. that they felt needed to be hidden.
Yeah.
And also then my art that I did was destroyed.
Oh.
You know, all of what I had created was destroyed by others. My diaries destroyed by others. So I do think there has been certain moments in which there were people who were saying, this is, you can't be seen doing this or you can't do that and what you're doing is controversial. And I have never, ever understood the lengths at which the gathering has gone to try to feel that there's a reason to hide what we have done. Mm-hmm. I'm not hiding stuff here. I'm just saying it plainly as it happened, and people can take it or leave it or make use of it or not. I'm not going to defend anything that occurred that really was abusive, because I do know that there are people in the gathering who have done abusive things. People in the gathering who have tried to imitate Adida's role as it was removed from him, mm-hmm. trying to orchestrate certain kinds of considerations in the gathering in the manner that was done in a truly sacred domain that ended up hurting individuals. People not prepared to actually educate or initiate or instruct individuals that have ended up consequentially having people make decisions about their lives that it were not a good idea to do it, but then them feeling like they were coerced into doing it, financial contributions or changing their work or ending their relationship or taking on a new job, all because they were associated with Adi Dom mm-hmm. and being involved with individuals or practitioners speaking about these things with them, or maybe even extending themselves to asking somebody close to Adi Da to bring this to Adi Da's attention. And Adi Da was never in a position to be able to be completely certain that what left his mouth or left his room or left his home went out into the ashram, that it was ever going to actually be true to what he said or the manner in which he actually said it or the actual purpose for which he said it. You can never guarantee that unless there was something that was returned that actually showed the signs of the reception of that. One thing I can say that's really true without a doubt is that Adi Da never did anything ever in my experience that did not extend from the true heart passion to awaken beings in relationship to reality, truth itself, or love, bliss. There was always a logic of purity inherent in the crazy wisdom method of his free fall into life and no recoil in relationship to it to be completely available to help someone awaken. And that was what kept me in the process, that certainty in relationship to him, is that no matter how emotionally reactive or upset I may have felt at times, offended, betrayed, hurt, whatever kind of emotion I might have felt, sorrow, that I would always come to the point of deeply examining it in relationship to the spiritual process and the relationship to what it was that he was revealing. And that even magnified itself more profoundly when he passed away, because again, the physical embodiment of his form as an other no longer was there to be able to objectify. And yet the very process of his presence and his person continued to be the very means and mechanism of evaluation and discrimination and integrity. That was the Adi Da that I knew at heart, that eternal process that's always present.
Well, I have to imagine, Julie, that overall, you feel immense gratitude for the years that you spent in his company and in his community.
Mm. Yes, I do. I do. And even with the present time struggles that continue, even my being here today speaking with you is a result of that gratitude. And if there is anything that I could do to help serve a real understanding of the purity, the fidelity, the integrity, and the seriousness required to stay with a spiritual process, even if it's not with Adi Da and his unique revelation, but any process of real human growth really requires that you stay the course. You really have to maintain the thread of that heart necessity for freedom and awakening and realization, because you will fall down the rabbit hole really quick, and it'll be very, very difficult to find your way out of it if you don't maintain that seed of heart impulse for freedom. Yeah.
Seed of heart impulse for freedom.
Mm. Mm.
Can you elaborate a little more on that?
Yes, yes. So in a conversation that we had earlier, and I was speaking with you about consciousness itself, the domain of consciousness itself, not being the mind or being completely connected with the brain mind, dependent upon the brain, that consciousness itself exists free, standing free in relationship to being itself, is being free of mind and experience, no matter what arises as experience or mind or body. Consciousness itself is pure and free and self-aware of itself. Consciousness itself is love, bliss. Itself is freedom. Itself. That's a hard intuition. That's a seed. An intuition is a seed. And that seed in the spiritual process, that intuition, is an awakening that flowers out and opens and grows, and the whole psychophysical being has to be participating in that responsibly, in order for that seed or that intuition to grow, to become the condition within which you are living. The intuition becomes the condition. So the impulse to realize that most perfectly is the seed and impulse that flowers, and you have to stay steadfast in that impulse and never look back. Don't settle for less. If it's identified with an experience or with a thought in mind, it will pass. So it can't be dependent upon that. The love bliss of consciousness itself is not dependent on experience or mind.
Beautifully put. And I gather, I sometimes think of that as the divine spark.
Yes.
That's within each one of us.
Sure.
Always there.
Yep.
All the time.
Exactly. Yeah, the fire, the flame, the spark, the seed, the impulse. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, exactly.
Well, Julie Anderson, once again, what a fascinating, insightful, wholesome, and heartfelt conversation.
Likewise, genuinely so. And it doesn't occur when there isn't a reciprocation. That's important to acknowledge, so thank you for the availability and the openness to be able to feel. And
I'm very grateful that you made the trip to Albuquerque.
I am too. And yes, your home is a sanctuary. An extraordinary sign of your openness with all of what you have.
An oasis of bliss.
It is. It is. It's beautiful. And so many cultures, yeah. And in all the forms that are present in this, it's a temple. It really is. It's beautiful.
Well, it's my pleasure to invite you into the temple. And
thank you.
We are in the inner chamber.
Yes, we are. Yeah. And it's a blessing for all that you've brought into this sphere of your investigation and your consideration of consciousness itself.
Well, thank you for bringing the spirit of Adi Da into the inner chamber.
Yeah, thank you.
With me. And for those of you listening or watching, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason that we are here. I imagine that by now, many of you already realize that, in conjunction with White Crow Books, we've just launched the new Thinking Aloud Dialogues book imprint, and our first title is There Life After Death? New Thinking Aloud is a nonprofit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.